if you're looking towards the last, I guess, month and a half here of the fantasy season, and you're trying to find a starter on the waiver wire who could actually put together a good couple of months, I don't think Nova is your worst pick out there.
Okay. I guess so.
It's a resounding agreement from Matt Collins.
I've watched a lot of Ivan Nova, and I mean, this is definitely personal bias, and I just can't imagine a scenario where I'd want to trust him.
Episode 74 of There Is No Off-Season, Baseball Prospectus' podcast focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. As you'll notice, I am not Ben Carsley, the normal host. This is Craig Goldstein, the minor league editor for Baseball Prospectus. And since Ben and Brett are both on vacation, I have asked BP Fantasy authors J.P. Breen and Matt Collins to join me. How are you doing, gentlemen?
Just lovely.
Doing all right.
Okay, it's going to be a rip-roaring episode, I can tell. We're really excited. You can follow us on Twitter at Tino Podcast and get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. We'll get to the rest of the housekeeping later. In the meantime, I figure what we're going to talk about today is just go through some trade deadline reactions. There was a lot of movement, a lot of it involving JP's specialty, which is the Brewers. And then we'll also talk about kind of how things shook out in the closer world, which is Matt's specialty, and hopefully get some middle reliever talk in as well, because that's the most important thing in a Dynasty Fantasy League. So before we do that, I want to get to the important thing here, which is not only our Ben and Brett gone, but Loot Crate is now gone. Our favorite sponsor has opted to use its time to talk more about WWE, which is something that Twitter has enough of as is. And so we've moved on in terms of sponsorship. And fortunately, we have a great option in PennantWars.com. Pennant Wars is an online baseball management game where you call all the shots as GM of your own baseball franchise in its fictional universe. You build a team that plays to your brand of baseball by drafting and developing amateurs, spending big in the free agent market, or making blockbuster trades with other owners. It's an in-depth and realistic simulation engine, which plays out a full 162-game season, pitch by pitch. And the good news is it only takes course over 6 weeks. And as soon as that period is over, you can start up a new one. So the Pennant Wars universe is always on, meaning you can check in anywhere you get internet, at home, on your phone, at work. You can get your baseball, your fantasy baseball fix year-round with Pennant Wars. As soon as one season ends and the champion is crowned, the next one begins the next days. Head over to PennantWars.com and try it out for free today. There will be a link in our post that can direct you to that. All right, with that out of the way, let's talk about the trade deadline and go. We'll start off with the Brewers. JP, you obviously have a longstanding kind of affection for the Brewers. I don't know if it's affection at this point in this season, or it probably goes up and down. But why don't you walk us through kind of what they did, and we can break down kind of what went on from a fantasy angle.
Yeah, it was long anticipated continuation of the rebuilding process in Milwaukee, and so they were able to take advantage of the inflated, I don't even know if it's an inflated reliever market at this point. I mean, it's kind of an established reliever market. Yeah. Will Smith got moved to bolster the Giants' bullpen, give them a lefty option that's been a little bit better than their longstanding guy, Javier Lopez. And they were able to bring back Andrew Susak, who, in terms of fantasy potential, has seen his stock rise pretty dramatically by moving to Milwaukee. And Phil Bickford, I guess we can kind of talk about it, maybe an overrated pitching prospect, is moving to Milwaukee. But then they were able to move a combination of Luke Roy and Jeremy Jeffress to Texas. We're able to bring over Lewis Brinson, who I know Craig is a big fan of, has a lot of thoughts on. And then Luis Ortiz, and then a player to be named later. So a lot of movement, continued influx, especially into the upper echelons of the Brewers organization, and definitely some, I guess, value increase and decrease in terms of fantasy potential, especially in guys like Jeffress, you know, who Matt, I'm sure, can talk about a little bit more in terms of how his potential looks going forward in terms of racking up saves and whatnot. But a lot of movement in terms of real life rebuilding. The Brewers are kind of taking a step forward in what they're trying to do. And I mean, I'd say probably have a top 3 to 5 organization in terms of a farm system right now in the league. I mean, I don't know. Some people are trying to say it's number one. I don't necessarily know if it's up there yet, but I feel comfortable saying it's a top 5 system in the league right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think Callis, I think, had them at number one in his recent one. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing that's been, because of course Brewers Twitter doesn't really have anything else to talk about at this point, so they've been trying to glom onto the fact that they were called the number one prospect by somebody, and then just trying to blow that up at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's an unreasonable point of view. I think, you know, there's maybe a couple other options, but I'd put them in top three pretty comfortably and probably in my top two. I think obviously Brinson, in my mind, as a fantasy asset, was the biggest piece moved here in terms of a minor league piece. I think that, you know, he has such a baseline because of his speed that if he gets the playing time because of his defense, he can be valuable because of his speed. And while he's kind of had a tough year going back to Double A, he had reached Triple A last year, and they sent him back to Double A Frisco to start the year. And I don't think he tore it up kind of the way that they thought he would. But at the same time, he has been tinkering with his swing over the years. I mean, he entered the system striking out over 25%. You know, everyone made a big deal about Joey Gallo's strikeout rate back in 2013 when he crushed everything in Low A in that fabled Hickory squad. But Brinson's was 38%, his strikeout rate that year. And this year he's brought it down to under 20% in Double A with the Rangers. The Brewers bumped him up immediately to Triple A, and he's under 15% in 9 games there so far. I mean, it's obviously a very small sample size, but for him to make that kind of improvement gives me hope that, you know, he can continue to adjust, especially when he hits the majors, because I do think he's going to get exploited a little bit. And yet, you know, if he can make those adjustments, even if he can only hit 250, 260, with his type of power, I think he could easily be a 15-15 guy, if not maybe a 20-20 guy. And that's kind of the biggest piece that was, I thought, moved as a minor leaguer in the Brewers deals. And it did kind of seem to me that the Brewers were were something of the everyone was waiting to see what they would do. You know, they had the failed Luke Roy deal to Cleveland, and then there just wasn't that much movement. Whereas last year, I mean, I think the whole week was ridiculous when it comes to transactions. And then this year, it all kind of happened starting, I guess, you know, early the day of the deadline, which was, I guess, what, Monday, right? Monday, August 1st this year. So I thought he was the biggest fantasy asset moved. You know, I like Luis Ortiz, but he's not particularly dynamic as a fantasy asset. I think he's going to be like a mid rotation pitcher, and you know, he'll miss bats, but it's nothing crazy or top of the rotation type. I don't know, Matt, did you have any thoughts on guys I didn't mention or disagree anywhere?
Yeah, so I think Susak is probably the guy I'm most excited about. Not in terms of overall talent, I would agree that would be Brinson, but just in terms of near near-term value. Catcher is so bad right now, and Cusack obviously didn't really have anywhere to play in San Francisco, and I think we all knew that at some point or another he was going to get traded. And the fact that he got traded to a park like Milwaukee is really nice for his value, and I'm not sure how long he'll stay there since Nottingham is coming up at some point, but just in terms of the next couple of years, I think Cusack is probably the guy I'm most excited about in terms of value.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, JP, do you have a sense of maybe what the timetable is or a plan for the organization in terms of how they're going to stack these guys? It obviously makes sense that Cusack would be the immediate guy, but Nottingham isn't too far. What, he's at Double A at this point already, right?
Yeah, he is, but it's been a little bit of a different kind of development path for him that I think a lot of people were expecting, because the question for him was really his defense and not so much his bat. And he's struggled offensively this year. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think he's necessarily as sure of a thing as people were projecting maybe a year ago. And Cusack, I kind of thought he would be brought up as a reserve outfielder right away, just trying to kind of learn from Maldonado a little bit, learn the pitching staff and have an opportunity to catch more once September rolls along. But it looks like it might actually be a little bit of a longer term in terms of maybe allowing him to start learning the pitching staff and step into a more central role as a catcher in, in spring training. So March, April. The thing about Brinson, though, moving back to that, is a place like Milwaukee and under a manager like Craig Counsell, in which he has been giving his players, especially this year, the freedom to run pretty much at will, not being as concerned about how many times a guy is being caught stealing. I mean, Jonathan Villar has been caught, I think, 15 times this year. Obviously, you know, the success rate for him is a little bit skewed because he does steal so many bags, but he's not going to a place where he's not going to be allowed freedom to run. And for fantasy owners, that's important. Obviously, you know, Matt talked about the park, and the park is going to be big, but it gives him a great place to try to maximize what he does bring to the table for fantasy owners. And that's speed and power, exactly like you said. And the Brewers organization is going to have a lot of freedom to allow him to grow at the major league level and potentially not be sending him up and down as a team who is competing and maybe wouldn't have time to deal with the growing pains that somebody like Brinson probably is going to bring in his first cup of coffee.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And that's something that you and I know have talked about when we've talked about ideas for articles. I've always thought about, you know, like, take a look at the new managers and see how they treat their guys in terms of whether they let them run, whether they have tendencies to do that type of thing. So, you know, knowing that about Counsell and being able to apply it to Brinson's opportunities kind of before everyone else sees what he's going to be like and whether he's going to run there is definitely an opportunity to kind of swoop in. I don't know that you're going to get him cheap, but you might get him, you know, if someone thinks, like I said, maybe a 15 stolen base guy, but if he really lets guys go, maybe he's something more than that. And I definitely think Cusack is a big name to mention. And like Matt said, just the utter lack of offense at catcher in a lot of ways means that a guy like him, who, you know, he came up a few years ago in, was it 2015, maybe 2014, he came up and, you know, he slugged like 460, and it wasn't a ton of games, it was 35 games, but, you know, having someone with that type of power, he's not a great hitter, but I don't think he'll kill you in average, especially from the catcher spot, and he could be, you know, the park is going to fit his ability to hit for power really well as well. So that covers the Brewers end of it. From a fantasy angle, I mean, Will Smith was not really, you know, he wasn't closing. It doesn't really change much in that sense. But do you think he has a shot at closing, Matt, in San Francisco? I know the San Francisco fans tend to be unhappy with Santiago Casilla, despite a pretty decent track record.
Yeah, I don't see it, at least not this year. Like you said, I think Kaseya kind of gets a bad rep. He's kind of boring, and he's definitely not perfect, but I think he's probably going to hold on to the job, and even if he doesn't, they still have Sergio Romo, and Corey Guerin, I believe, is going to be back at some point, so there's just a lot of guys for Smith to jump, and with him being a lefty, they're probably going to want to keep him in more of a situational role, so I don't really see him being a fantasy asset anytime soon.
Yeah, it's Kaseya being a guy that gets so much disdain, it always makes me laugh because I think I looked it up this offseason. I don't think he's had a season under a 2.8 ERA in the past 5 years. And so it's like, not that ERA is the be-all and end-all, but when you're a reliever, you know, it kind of comes down to what you let in and what you don't. And it's kind of funny that he gets so much crap given how consistent he's been and how consistently good.
Yeah, it just seems like he never puts together, like, month-long runs. Every few starts he'll give up a run, and then so that kind of adds up and is frustrating, but at the end of the year that always ends up as a solid guy.
Okay, and so for Texas, Jeffress went over to Texas. Dyson is the closer there. Is he, do you think Dyson's going to hold on to that? Or I thought Jeffress was really impressive and kind of thought he might have a shot to overtake Dyson, maybe not immediately, but maybe sometime next season.
So that's probably the most interesting bullpen in the league for me right now. I honestly don't think either of those guys are going to be the closer next year. They're really similar in that they kind of rely on weak contact and they don't strike a ton of batters out. So I think that at some point, whether that be at the end of this year or next year, you're going to see either Matt Bush or Keon Kella take over that job. Those are both just more stereotypical closers. They have the big strikeout numbers. They have the big stuff. And then you can kind of use Dyson and Jeffress as guys to come in with runners on base and try and get that double play ball. So I think this really hurt Jeffress's fantasy value. I like him as a real-life reliever, and I think he's an important piece for a contending bullpen, but I'm not really sure if he's going to be getting saves anymore unless he goes to a different team.
All right, that makes sense. And then flipping over, you know, and closing back to Milwaukee, obviously Jeffress and Will Smith vacated the back end of that bullpen. It looks like Thornburg is the guy right now. Is that right, or is there someone else you see coming up? And obviously, Matt, go ahead and answer it, but JP, if you have thoughts on it kind of long term, feel free to chime in.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's pretty clearly Thornburg right now. I don't really know if there's, I mean, I guess Corey Knebel, I don't know if that's, I'm awful at pronouncing names, so.
Yeah, I think it's Knebel.
Yeah, but I mean, he's probably, I guess, the only other guy who could come up, but at least for the rest of this year, I would think Thornburg's that guy.
Yeah, I mean, Thornburg definitely has a pretty firm hold on the ninth inning. So if there are fantasy owners looking for, you know, who to grab for the closer's role and are worried that Thornburg is maybe just somebody who's going to have it for a couple of weeks, that's not the case. I mean, I think he's been fantastic pretty much across the board, whether you're looking at run prevention or you're looking at advanced stats. He's been great. Corey Knebel, on the other hand, is, as our friend Jason Parks would say, is a Texan. So, I mean, that probably isn't taken into account in too many fantasy leagues, but I think that is also important to note.
Sure. Okay, so I think that kind of covers Milwaukee's side of it. I think the other big mover was New York. Obviously, we saw Chapman go to Chicago and supplant Hector Rondon in terms of a closing thing, which killed me in about three different leagues. That was really helpful. Chapman, obviously, unless he returns, I guess I'm assuming, I'm under the operating assumption that Rondon will retake that job next year, assuming the Cubs don't re-sign Chapman. Is that a safe assumption, Matt? Or, I mean, he's been very good statistically, but it always seems, I mean, and it clearly seemed like the Cubs felt they needed help on the back end.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think I said in the closer report after Chapman got traded that Rondon could be a nice kind of buy low in a dynasty league, especially if you're out of it this year, because I think he should take back that closer role, and there's no reason to believe the Cubs won't be really good again next year, so he should have plenty of save opportunities. So obviously if you're competing this year, that kind of sucks, but in the future I think he'll go back to being a pretty valuable fantasy asset.
Yeah, and on the flip side, good news for people who were patient or savvy enough to find Dellin Betances before this trade deadline, because Miller went out the door as well. And it doesn't seem, I mean, that I think is pretty straightforward analysis. He's the closer in New York, and he's obviously already, he was basically already worth rostering anyway. The interesting thing to me is I just went and saw the Nationals play the Indians. I know this series they've brought in Miller as a fireman. It seems like they're sticking with Cody Allen in the closer's role in Cleveland.
I think it's more of a split thing. I think that they want Miller to get the ninth inning more often than not, but if it's the seventh, eighth inning and there's a bunch of tough lefties coming up, they won't hesitate to bring him in. So I think you really should be rostering both of them. And it's definitely frustrating if you're a Miller owner, but he'll still get his saves.
Yeah, it's essentially the when running back tandem, like in fantasy football.
Yeah, basically.
It's unfortunate, but it's just kind of the way things are going to be. So the prospects going involved in those deals, in the Miller and Chapman deal, I think, you know, my point of view on Torres, who was the headliner going back in the Chapman deal, I don't know if he's the fantasy stud that he is in terms of real life value. And I'm not even sure that, you know, I had my top 50 list come out. I was not as high on Torres as some other places. And I think there's reasonable disagreement there. It's just he's got kind of across the board tools and is certainly polished and impressive production for his age. But I don't see it necessarily in kind of a linear development path in terms of just building upon those stats. I think it's something where he might reach his ceiling relatively quickly. And while that's a useful ceiling in fantasy, it's going to be mostly average based with a little bit of pop, a little bit of speed. I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on Torres, kind of separate from mine in concurrence, anything?
I mean, I think the shortstop position is so good right now with so many young shortstops, and looking at the top 50, it was something like there are 12 or 13 shortstops in that list.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, and we had 19 in the top 101, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is Torres is not a singular talent that makes him, it doesn't inflate his value as much as it maybe would if he were playing in a different era, if that makes sense. He is somebody that I think the Cubs recognize that they could replace, and I think a lot of dynasty owners would be wise to recognize that his value right now is inflated just because, number one, he played for the Cubs, and that'll inflate anybody's prospect value. And now he's going to the Yankees, which will also do the same. So there are a lot of opportunities right now to capitalize on the name brand and the fact that he is being ranked very, very aggressively. Because I think, as you said, even if he does become a useful major leaguer, I think it's his fantasy value is not matched by his prospect ranking. And I think a lot of fantasy owners, especially dynasty owners, still make the mistake too many times of basing their dynasty picks and their fantasy value based off of prospect lists rather than understanding where that fantasy value really lies.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt, any thoughts?
No, I was basically going to say what JP said. If he came along 3 years ago, I think I'd be a lot more excited than I am right now, but just the way the position is, he's probably an overvalued asset.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And, you know, the other names involved, I just don't think have a ton of fantasy relevance, although if I am glossing over anyone, obviously feel free to point that out. The Miller deal was a little bit different, as you saw Clint Frazier, who's been on prospect, you know, fantasy radar since the moment he was drafted, if not before, when he was in competition with Austin Meadows for best prospect in the state of Georgia. Frazier's been an interesting guy. He's been really impressive. I think, you know, he's someone I have multiple, you know, I mean, I've been an Austin Meadows guy, especially compared to Clint Frazier for a while. I was a Bradley Zimmer guy because they were both in the same system and people compared them all the time. But, you know, he's someone that consistently throughout his career has hit in the he's hit for average, which everyone was worried about. He's got this great bat speed, but you know, it's going to be a power bat, but is he going to be able to hit for average? And you know, I saw him in spring training this year swing through some mediocre fastballs, and I guess that'll happen from time to time with him, but he's hitting the 270s, 280s pretty much regularly. He was walking this year in Double-A. It's been a little bit of a different story in Triple-A, but you know, 13 games, we don't need to judge it too much. And he is hitting for power, and he's done it all. He's just going to turn 22 later this year. Him going from, not that Cleveland is a bad place to hit, but him going from Cleveland to the new Yankee Stadium, I think is a pretty big boon for his value. I know he's not necessarily, he's not going to take advantage of that short field and right porch, the short porch and right field all the time, but I still think that it's overall a good place to hit and something that he's going to be able to take advantage of. I don't know, how much did this move the needle for you, Matt, in terms of his prospect value specifically?
I'm really excited about it. Just like you said, hitting at Yankee Stadium, and especially I think in points leagues, it's going to help a lot too, because you have that power alley in left center field that he's going to take advantage of, and that'll help with the doubles. So as a Red Sox fan, I'm not super stoked about it, but for somebody who owns him in a long-term league, I'm definitely excited about this move.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, pretty much everyone who's not a Yankee fan was probably not happy at this deadline, given how well the Yankees did. I think they did a really good job. Justice Sheffield was the other big name involved. JP, do you have any specific thoughts on him before I over-explain anything?
I do think that one of the things not talked about with Frazier so much are the fact that he had to cut his hair, and it's
another example of the Yankees ruining everything.
Yeah, I mean, not only is it just borderline offensive, don't necessarily know if that's where all the power came from.
It's true. It might be a Samson effect. We don't know. I think we're gonna have to find out. It has been. He's not been really hitting for a ton of power, or well, I guess 485 slugging is pretty good, but he's striking out close to 30% with the Yankees. I think we can blame that on probably a helmet that doesn't fit at this point.
Yeah, I buy that. As far as Sheffield is concerned, I mean, to me, he's got some frame issues just in terms of being a little bit shorter, but I mean, I actually like him. I thought he was one of the top arms in Cleveland's organization, and he offers a chance to bring some strikeouts to the table as he moves up. But in terms of like what his stuff looks like and how it projects going forward, you know, he's not a guy that I've seen. So any kind of traction on that regard, I'm going to definitely cede to you, Craig.
Sure. And well, and he's the kind of guy that I was thinking about asking Matt, like, what, because you like relievers, what is it that you look for in a reliever that you like?
Well, probably my favorite thing would just be a strong breaking ball. I mean, that's what Andrew Miller kind of started my whole major reliever fetish when he was first starting with that slider. So I think that strong secondary to go with plus fastball, if not plus-plus, is definitely what I would look for the most.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm looking at, we have a report from Adam McInturf on our site, an eyewitness report with video on it, and I'm looking at Sheffield, and the question is, with him, you know, it's about his height, and kind of, he's got a little bit of a max effort, or I shouldn't say a little bit of a max effort, but he's got some effort in his delivery, and he's listed 5'10". I think he's probably, I've heard he's more of a 5'9", and that's just hard to hold up as a starter. And to, you know, I'm someone who supports, you know, shorter pitchers. I was in Yordano Ventura's camp, Carlos Martinez, although he's not that short, but you get the gist. I think the question for me is, and the reason I was kind of asking you, Matt, was he seems like an ideal bullpen arm to me, because it might not be that he can make it through the rigors of a full season, throw 200 innings or even 180 as a back end starter. But when you look at the stuff, it's a plus fastball, chance for a plus slider. I think Adam had him at above average right now. He also works in a cutter and a changeup. So he might, you know, he might have the ability to give you a starter's arsenal from a relief spot. And I don't know if you're constantly just looking at what's available because there are so many relievers, or when you look at prospects, you're kind of like, yeah, this guy's going to make a dominant reliever. Maybe he's Tyler Thornburg, which was, you know, the issue with Thornburg was always stature as well. So that's kind of what Sheffield is in my mind. And he was obviously a big name to go from Cleveland to New York. But I think in terms of fantasy, we were probably looking at a reliever either way. And I don't know, do you have a specific philosophy? I think it's something we can get to a little later, but on speculating on relievers, or is it something that you engage in, or do you just kind of wait to see how it shakes out each season?
I usually don't try to speculate on minor league relievers. There's so many guys in middle relief that can always take that quicker jump to a fantasy relevant role. So, I definitely will check out Sheffield. That's not something I had really thought about with him, but that would be more just for a personal thing than for fantasy. I don't really like getting somebody who's in a A-ball for a relief role.
Yeah, I think that obviously makes sense. And that's generally the approach I take as well, that it's just not worth doing for minor league guys. I think, you know, it can vary depending on the situation at the major league level. But when you're talking about potential relievers in the minors, I had people trading in an AL-only league, trading Cam Bedrosian like 2-3 years ago. And it's like, oh, he's going to be their closer. And, you know, now he had that opportunity now. But, you know, in the meantime, you wasted a few years of a roster spot. Speaking of prospects that are probably going to be minor leaguers, the Dodgers acquired Josh Reddick and Rich Hill and traded a bunch of guys who are probably going to be relievers. Grant Holmes is the biggest name. I think he's got a chance to start. He is pretty stocky as well, but he's kind of thick throughout. And I think he could hold up. It's more a question of the changeup. But dealing with the major leaguers first, JP, did you have any thoughts on that deal?
I mean, Pomeranz aside, I think that Rich Hill was probably the most realistic get, but he fits in with a lot of Dodgers pitchers. And I mean, you know, it's a little bit glib to say it, but he's a guy that when he's on the mound can actually bring some quality fantasy statistics pretty much across the board. I mean, he brings strikeouts. It's a good offense behind him, so he does have a chance to rack up some wins, especially with Jansen locking down the ninth inning. So Hill, in terms of if he's healthy,
right? If he ever has doesn't have a blister, I should
say. Right? Or, you know, tweaks his ankle when he's walking down the steps, or I don't know, catches his finger in the door. I don't know. Like there are just a lot of things that make that very difficult. I've never been a Josh Reddick fan, so I understand that he does bring good fantasy stats to the table and generally is more like year to year brings more fantasy value than I think I recognize, but it's just never been a package that I really like. So I don't know, that always blunts it for me a little bit.
I'm with you on Reddick. I thought he was, you know, the low average, high power guy for a while. He's seemingly changed his approach. I mean, Matt, you had both of these guys in Boston at some point, obviously years apart, but what was your, I mean, have you stuck with Reddick? Have you followed his kind of progression, and do you have a read on him?
Yeah, a little bit. I think I probably like him a little more than you guys. I kind of don't really mind the low average, high power guys. Sure. Obviously, in terms of fantasy, it kind of depends on how the rest of your team is built. And you kind of need a special kind of supporting cast to support somebody like Reddick. But I think that he, I don't know, he's a free agent at the end of the year, right? So,
yes. Yep.
So I don't know. I mean, obviously playing in LA isn't the best for his fantasy value, and obviously he's gotten off to a pretty horrible start. But
no, I think negative 15 OPS plus is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, all right, I guess that works. But I mean, depending on where he goes next year, I think he could be a pretty solid buy low in the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, the question for me with him is, do you know what you're buying? Because so he hit 20 homers in 2015. But then this year, you know, again, he was hitting .296 with Oakland, only 8 home runs, though. So, like, do you have a sense of, do you think he's just going to start splitting the difference, maybe be a .270s guy with moderate power, or?
I'll admit I don't watch a ton of Oakland A's baseball these days, so.
It's a tough watch.
I don't really have a sense of exactly what he's changed, but I would guess that he's probably going to get back to being a 20 to 25 home run guy if he goes to a solid park for him.
Okay, and so just I'll ask both of you same question for not the same question, but I'm going to ask you the same question. With Rich Hill, from what I'm looking at on CBS, they have him as he's ranked 138th this year. Do you think he's a top 150 player next year? That's not just at pitchers. That's overall.
Next year?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I say no.
Okay, it's just too much. I mean, the odds are that he's falling out of that the longer it takes him to get back on the mound. I assume it's less an effectiveness thing than time spent on the mound.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and so I'm trying to think, what other trades am I missing here?
Well, it's been a while since we recorded, so, I mean, throw Matt a bone and let's talk about Pomeranz for Espinoza.
Oh, we did cover that on the last one, but Matt, I'm certainly willing to take your thoughts and have them trump whatever Ben said.
So I was telling JP before we started recording that from a Red Sox standpoint, I like the trade. The only thing I'm upset about is I never got to see Espinoza in person. He didn't stop at Lowell, and he obviously didn't make it to Portland at that point. So I can't really speak too much to how he looks long term, other than what you can read from scouting reports. But in terms of Pomeranz, I was really excited at first, but watching him since he's come to the Red Sox as in terms of fantasy, I don't know. It seems like American League lineups are kind of taking advantage of him, and he's not making it deep into games, and he's walking more batters. I'm not really sure what he looks like in terms of fantasy for the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's fair. I think he's another guy that like you said has trouble staying on the mound, and so it's. Part of the appeal with him was team control, but I think the bigger issue is kind of what you're getting control of at some point. Obviously, he was very good with San Diego with the cutter, but the AL East is something of a different beast in that sense. Just to cover a little more recent news, obviously, Alex Reyes just got called up. He's come up as a reliever, so have you had a chance to catch him, Matt? Yeah, no, I think it's fine. I have him in an NL only, and the only thing I'm wondering about is whether I want to bring him up and use kind of a year of eligibility. I won't get the saves, obviously, but he probably will put up some decent stats. At the same time, all it takes is, something, to crop up with O, before he's probably in the closer role, because I think the next guy after, or is O hurt already? I might be.
No, right. I don't think so.
He's all right. Yeah, but the guy after him is they don't really have a ton of options in that bullpen, right?
They have Segrist, who I kind of like.
Oh yeah, Segrist, right?
Yeah, I mean he's not really the same kind of a dominant arm, but I guess if you're in that kind of situation that you're in, I'd probably call him up just because. With pitchers, I usually, in that kind of situation, I would just say, yeah, I'll take the year right now, because I don't know what's going to happen down the road. But and you could probably get some strikeouts and some solid ratios. But I really, even if O gets hurt, there's Segrist, there's Broxton. They have other guys, so I don't really see any role to him getting more than like one or two token saves.
And just staying in recent news, what the hell are we supposed to do with the Angels bullpen?
just don't even look at it. It's so bad. It's like the Reds for most of this year. If you really want to go there, I guess Fernando Salas is that guy. But yeah, just hope that Streeter Bedrosian comes back soon, because it's brutal.
Yo, is Salas actually closing for them right now?
Yeah. Oh, it's a committee, but I'm pretty sure he's their best reliever right now. So,
well, best is a relative term. Always important.
Yeah, there's him and Deolis Guerra.
Yeah, he did get a chance last week and he blew the save. So, that's pretty symbolic.
Sam Miller literally today has an article with the 10 saddest age 27 seasons of 2016, and Guerra is on it.
So yeah, I saw that.
That doesn't speak well to the to the Angels bullpen. Continuing going kind of around the league. JP, have you been keeping track of Alex Bregman since his call up? I know he obviously, I don't think he had a hit in what, his first 34 at bats or plate appearances or something like that. Or do you have any kind of not long-term concerns, but short or even, intermediate concerns with Bregman?
I don't, but full disclosure, I've been dealing with trying to move into a house. So I actually haven't been following Alex Bregman pretty much at all over the last week. But painted all the houses, all the rooms in my house, and it looks really nice.
All right. Well, that's some good fantasy nuggets. Matt, have you had a chance to see him at all or have any thoughts on Bregman?
Yeah. I'm not really worried about the talent, obviously. I think if he plays, he'll be fine. The only thing I guess I'd be worried about is Gurriel. I think it's probably coming up soon.
That's the big question.
Yeah, so I don't know how they're going to divvy up that playing time. But in terms of pure talent, I'm not worried.
Yeah, no, I think he'll be fine long-term, and that's why I didn't even really want to address it long-term. There's no sense in panicking or giving up on a guy this early, this talented this early. But it is a question as to kind of where he'll play and if that's going to mess with him. If Gurriel comes up and plays third, do they try and put him in left field? And if so, is learning a new position going to affect him at the plate? And if it is going to affect him, can it possibly make him worse? Or are we kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel here? That is the other thing going on in Houston. I don't think Bregman is really an option for center, although I guess you could shift him to right or something and put Springer in center.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. If that's an opportunity to bring up Gurriel for third base, switch Bregman to right field, move Springer to center, and that being just kind of an overall improvement.
Yeah, it could be. The tough part is, Bregman as of today is hitting 150, 224, 217. So the question is what you're improving on. As bad as Gomez was, are they really, is that an improvement in the short term? Obviously, I think in the long term, there's a difference there. But
yeah, I guess Bregman went 1-for-4 with a walk, couple RBI today.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's been pretty good lately, right? Last few games, week or so.
We can talk about it. I can check on that. I guess the other thing with Gomez is Gomez. You had him a ton of time in Milwaukee. JP, is he irredeemable? Do you think at this point?
No, because the thing about Carlos Gomez that's always driven people mad is the fact that his skill set is so volatile in terms of not just his swing, but in terms of, momentum, in terms of personality, in terms of confidence and different things like that. And just based on an outsider's perspective of what's happening in Houston and just knowing Gomez from when he was in Milwaukee and just, knowing people around him and stuff, I think he got into a place where he started to try way too hard to be the guy that Houston paid top prospects for and to be a leader and to be a middle of the order hitter. And I think once he started dealing with injuries And once he started to struggle, I mean, that was the case when he was first coming up to the majors, is he put way too much pressure on things. He tried too hard. He tried to be somebody he wasn't. You know, at that time, it was to be a high ground ball hitter and somebody who kind of put constraints on his swing, you know, based on a lot of arguably bad advice from a lot of hitting coaches, just looking at him and not realizing that he's, you know, 6'3 and massive. And I think that Gomez is somebody that doesn't need to hit for that high of an average to be valuable in fantasy. And coming into this season, he was somebody who was being drafted outside of the first two or three rounds that does have the power speed capability to be a, you know, a top 10 fantasy outfielder. And I don't think that that's gone. It's just a matter of, you know, maybe he signs with Atlanta or something like that and can really try to regain his confidence and perform outside of anybody paying attention to him. You know, and he does what Melvin Upton was able to do, where he hits 280, hits 15 homers and steals 15 bags. I mean, that is within the realm of possibility, and just kind of bailing on him, especially looking at what he's done in the past and kind of the fluctuation that he's had in his statistics, I think is kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Some of the other trades that I was that I had neglected at this point and allows us to hit on more relievers is Melanson went from Pittsburgh to Washington. I think, you know, the analysis on his portion of the deal is pretty straightforward. Tony Watson has been very good the last couple of years in Pittsburgh. I assume he holds down that gig in Pittsburgh, and that Felipe Rivero isn't really an option, even though he's been quite good in 2016, Matt.
Yeah, so it's Watson right now. He has been a little worse this year than usual. His walks are up and his home runs are up. But I'm pretty confident that he could hold on to the job. And if he doesn't, I think it's Neftali Feliz after him. He's been pretty good this year. And so I think if you're looking for speculative saves and the waiver wire is pretty barren, you could take a chance on Feliz. But gun to my head, I'd say Watson's probably good enough to hold that job for the rest of the year.
Is Feliz signed after it's just 1 year deal, right?
I think so. I'm honestly not sure though.
We can check that, and I can also loop back. Bregman has a 5-game hitting streak, including his hit today. He went 3-for-5 on August 6th. So that was and he's had one hit in the other game. So not on fire, but certainly piecing it together in that sense.
Yeah, so Feliz is a free agent after this year.
Okay, so I mean,
and
if
Watson
you're...
remains under control.
Yeah, Watson's still there, so.
And if speculating long-term, then Rivero would probably be the way to go, right?
Yeah, definitely. But I think, I don't know. I would say long-term, it's still probably Watson, though. I wouldn't really. If you're looking towards next year, I mean, he's been consistent enough where even if he loses it for a couple weeks this year, they'll probably give him another chance to start next year.
Yeah, and I don't think that the Pirates would have made that move if they didn't have confidence in Watson being able to hold it down long-term.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the other big trade that we should address was Matt Moore going from Tampa to San Francisco. Matt, I know you watch obviously a lot of AL East starts. Do you have any insights on Matt Moore? And do you think, you know, whatever he was putting together, I know he had a decent run ERA-wise heading into the break. Is that something that's sustainable?
Not really. I'm not the biggest Matt Moore fan. He's kind of been holding it together with duct tape and bubblegum. And, I mean, I would say that moving to San Francisco would be a help, but, I mean, it's not like Tampa's a tough pitcher's park, and obviously they've been really good at developing pitchers over the years. So if he can't put it together like that in Tampa, I'm not sure why I should be more confident in San Francisco. I mean, in a deeper league, he's probably useful in a deeper dynasty league as like a bottom end starter, somebody you can plug and play with the right matchups. But I mean, he's obviously never getting back to that status he had as a prospect.
Yeah, go ahead, JP.
I say I might push back on that a little bit, okay. Just because I think one of the big things that San Francisco is offering that Tampa wasn't is a competent defensive outfield behind him. And having a quality, I think, because I was looking at it, and I mean, I know partial year defensive statistics. I know I can already hear Craig yelling at me, but but it's one of those things that, you know, obviously when you think of just who has a better defense, whether it's the Giants or the Rays, I think the vast majority of us would say the Giants. And then the fact that that is borne out by a massive difference in the defensive statistics. I mean, it's not like you're parsing between, you know, somebody's ranked 10th and somebody's ranked 13th. I mean, it's the Rays being at the bottom and the Giants being in the top five.
And I don't think anyone's going to argue that, you know, when you have a healthy Angel Pagan or even a Gregor Blanco or Hunter Pence, those guys, and Denard Span, you know, those are all quality defenders. So
right. And so I think that being in a good ballpark, moving to the NL, having a better defense behind him, and being in a place that has a pretty, I mean, I do see your point in terms of Tampa having a good track record of developing pitchers. So I don't think that there's like necessarily that big of.
I was going to say the other thing with that is the Giants reputation, they have that reputation as well, but you know, Jeff Samardzija is a huge, you know, sore thumb in that regard, especially of late. So.
Yeah. But you know, there are some of us that would have said that when Jeff Samardzija went to the Giants, he wasn't that good in the first place.
Right. No, but there were many people arguing that they could fix him and turn him back to, you know, his Oakland, Chicago.
Sure. Yeah. But yeah. I think that becomes, you know, we forget about those things pretty quickly. I mean, we talk about Drew Hutchinson going to Pittsburgh and how that's a great scenario for him because of Ray Searidge. But, you know, we don't ever remember the arms that Ray Searidge wasn't able to fix. And so not everybody just because they moved to an organization. Listen, and I know that you know this.
I'm just trying to get shots in at Jeff Samardzija. Okay? That's really all what this is about.
Look, I am good for that. And now that, you know, I am at the University of Notre Dame now, so I can't speak too ill of him because I'm pretty sure that is in my contract for my stipend that I'm like, I have to be nice to people who went to Notre Dame.
Only in regards to football, right? No one actually cares.
Yeah, no one cares about baseball.
That's fair.
Yeah, dude. So just applaud his receiving, and
he is easily one of the top 10 receivers that pitch in the major leagues right now. Easily,
I think that's right. I think that's right, despite the mustache. yeah. So you bring up Drew Hutchison, I should say, and what can I just get your reactions? What the hell was that deal?
I mean, it had to have been clearing money, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was clearing money, but there's got to be a better way to do it than that.
They have to love Drew Hutchison. They just have to. Or just not give, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but they might, like, not
give. By all means.
Okay. So I was just saying, because my first reaction is I was like, they just don't give a shit about Harold Ramirez, like, at all.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, he's one of the names, some people like him as a guy who's lower down, he's just not on the radar as much, and he's obviously hit and performed decently well throughout his career thus far, but I think people don't realize that, well, he does run in the lower minors, he's kind of a thicker guy, I wouldn't necessarily anticipate that going forward, and, you know, Reese McGuire, not a huge, we've talked about him a ton on this podcast before, but not a huge offensive guy, despite the low bar at catcher. And I, you know, I'm still a fan of his overall, but for them to move two real life, you know, valuable prospects on top of Francisco Liriano, who just last year was evidence of the Ray Searidge effect, just blew my mind.
Yeah. It's weird. I mean, cause they've made some questionable trades actually, I think, I know that I am largely a big fan of what Pittsburgh has done and what they've been able to put together. But as somebody who follows the Brewers rather carefully, like the fact that they moved Trey Supak, who is, I believe, a recent second round pick, and Keon Broxton, who's now starting in center field for the Brewers, for Jason Rogers, who not only was like a 28-year-old rookie, but
they decided they wanted to play him at third base, which the Brewers had tried for like the last 3 years, and he was awful at third base. And I think that they traded real life things for a 28-year-old rookie who couldn't play third base because they didn't have a third baseman for 2 months and they thought they could make it work. And then when they found out in spring training it couldn't, they signed David Freese, who was probably the guy they should have signed in the first place.
Right.
Like, that, well, that also made no sense. And so these are a couple of trades that I've looked at and I said, that makes no sense to me, but they must absolutely love Drew Hutchison.
Well, I think you can extend it beyond that. I mean, if we just go back to the Melanson deal, I mean, we talked about what the market was for relievers. Melanson's been one of the best relievers over the last, you know, over 2014, 2015, and extending into this year, right? So why were they only able to get Felipe Rivero, who was having a good year and has a lot of team control, but Felipe Rivero and Taylor Hearn, who is extremely athletic and, you know, he's the kind of guy that is a great flyer to take on, you know, but when he's the second piece in your deal rather than the third or fourth, I mean, when we're looking at what Chapman is going for, even if you modulate down because Melanson isn't Chapman, it was kind of shocking that that was all they got for Melanson.
Well, yeah, but then there's also the question of how much age plays into it, though, right? Because if you look at what the Brewers were able to get for Francisco Rodriguez, they got Javier Betancourt, who's, you know, hitting 240 in Double A and maybe a utility infielder. And Rodriguez has been good, but I think the relief market is set if you're, like, under 32.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily sure what it looks at when you're a little bit older.
I think it's also... because I think if you look at Brad Ziegler, the Red Sox gave up nothing for him.
Right. And, but that's kind of in the Diamondbacks zone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my theory is that they got the Basave. I think that they got the Basave brothers confused on that. But that's another conversation. But I think you look at the strikeout numbers for Melanson, and he doesn't really fit with someone like Chapman or Miller or Kimbrel. And then with Will Smith, there's the age and control. So, I mean, Melanson's a few months of a guy who's been good, but he doesn't really have that closer stuff. So I wasn't too surprised that he didn't bring back a huge package.
Yeah, I guess in my mind, I wasn't surprised that it wasn't something monstrous, especially since it was a rental and all of the things that you said. But you kind of think that given the track record at this point, that since they're only buying a few months and given that he's had the track record of proven success for, you know, going on 3 years, 4 years, that was just kind of what surprised me. And, you know, it's not the highest strikeout rate. It's not the 105 mile per hour fastball, but he's striking out over 8 per 9. He's at 25%. It's not nothing either. You know, it's not Jeremy Jeffress even, right?
I mean,
he misses more bats than Jeffress does.
Well, you also wonder if, you know, by the same token of relievers in general being inflated, right? Because it's not just closers. If we're throwing Will Smith into the mix, maybe Rivero's value's a little bit higher than we think, right?
Sure.
Maybe that is like a legitimate piece coming back rather than just kind of, you know, a middle reliever.
Right. So to stick with the Pirates now, do either of you have hope for Ivan Nova now that he's in Tampa? Or not Tampa, Pittsburgh?
No, not really. I've seen enough of Ivan Nova to not want anything to do with him.
I just wrote about him.
Enlighten us.
Well, I was going to apologize. I mean, the biggest thing with Ivan Nova has always been... right, the strikeout or the home runs have been an issue, right? Mm-hmm. And so moving to a place like PNC, and he's actually, like, if you look at his CFIP and whatnot, it's 97. I mean, it's projecting him to be better than league average going forward, and his deserved run average has actually been down near 4. He's moving to a bigger ballpark that should hopefully lower his home run issues outside of his first start, you know. Because that looks stupid once you realize that he gave up homers in his first start with the Pirates. But, there are things for if you are speculating as a fan, if you're looking towards the last
month and a half here of the fantasy season, and you're trying to find a starter on the waiver wire who could actually put together a good couple of months, I don't think Nova is your worst pick out there. I mean, when you could be, I don't know, I don't even know who else you could be looking for. But to me, I think that there is something a little bit more where if you're in a standard, if you're in a standard league, I don't think you pay attention to him. But if you're in a deeper league and you need somebody for the last couple of months, I think you could do a lot worse than Nova.
Okay. I guess so.
It's a resounding agreement from Matt Collins.
I've watched a lot of Ivan Nova, and I mean, this is definitely personal bias, and I just can't imagine a scenario where I'd want to trust him at any point.
So it's a trust issue.
Yes, it's always a trust issue.
I got it.
Okay, and one other name that was relatively big that moved, obviously we talked about Matt Moore, the guy going back was Matt Duffy to Tampa. I mean, you know, he's coming off a 2015 where he shockingly hit 12 homers. He was hit .295, was much worse this year, was hurt for part of that. Do you guys see him as, I don't know, I'm not as good as Ben at ballparking this stuff, but I don't know, top 12 third baseman going forward? Is that reasonable, ambitious?
I probably take the under, but not by much. I'd probably say in the 12 to 15 range, maybe.
Okay, JP.
I'm not a big Matt Duffy fan. I would say outside that for sure.
Yeah, and I think the power was surprising for him in the first place, and then going to the trop is not going to serve him well in that capacity.
Right. The power was surprising, and he still had a 133 ISO. Like, yeah. It wasn't like he hit for a lot of power. It was nothing.
Right. Right. That's fair. So I don't know. Am I missing? Did I miss anything else or anyone else worth talking about? Wade Miley. Do we want to talk about him?
No.
Benintendi?
Benintendi came up. Yeah, Matt, go ahead. Talk.
We could talk about Joe Smith.
Talk about the good hair.
Yeah, I mean, the hair is unbelievable. He's got nice sideburns. I love Andrew Benintendi. He's probably the minor leaguer I've seen the most in my life between Lowell and Portland. I think he's a guy that if I was if I'm in a roto league, honestly, I might sell a little high on him because I think his value is as high as it's ever going to be. But in a points league, I think he's a guy who can hit 15 to 20 homers and then just demolish doubles all over the place. And at his peak, put up 40 double seasons. So with that plate discipline, I think he's more of a points league guy. But overall, he's just wonderful, and everything about him is delightful.
I can't argue with any of that. JP, do you have any Benintendi thoughts aside from puns?
No. No, actually, I like him quite a bit. I mean, and I don't know why I always make this connection, but he always reminds me a lot of what I think Kyle Schwarber could be, but with just a little bit lower power and a little bit more speed. But in terms of...
You're making, cross-body type comps here, and it's blowing my mind.
All right, I'll stop. We can talk about Joe Smith instead if you want.
No, it's fine. I just would not have ever thought the name you were going to say was Kyle Schwarber when you started that sentence talking about Benintendi. But carry on.
No, I mean, I saw Kyle Schwarber a few times in the Midwest League, and obviously now that he's in Chicago and that's where I am, like, you can't not hear about Kyle Schwarber. Actually, you hear a lot about Contreras now. But he has the same kind of approach, obviously with more swing and miss, but the same kind of approach and that I always look at, that I always associated with Benintendi for some reason, at least in terms of the walk rate and whatnot. And I didn't actually have too many great thoughts to move on behind that. So.
That's fine. I have a question I'm going to ask you instead. Dilson Herrera, obviously a beneficiary of getting out of Flushing and going to Cincinnati. It's a good place to hit. the opportunity is obviously a plus. Are you buying on the skill set?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that he's moving to I think Cincinnati's ballpark is a joke, first of all. So the fact that he is moving to
getting real. What do you think of Skyline Chili? Let's go there.
It's a pasta. It's what it is. but I think that, and yes, and also if you are a Cincy fan, it is JP_Breen. We can talk about it if you need to talk about it. But the fact that he's moving to a tinier ballpark, he should have a really nice opportunity at second base in Cincinnati. I actually think that he can hit 20 plus homers in a full season of at bats for Cincy. And it's crazy. He's only 22. It just seems like he's been knocking at the majors just forever. And it's been always, we've always been kind of,
he got to double A as a 20-year-old, right?
Yeah.
And
I mean, he even had his, he made his big league debut at 22, right? Or at 20 years old as well.
Right. I think that's right. He came up very late.
Yeah. And so I think there's a little bit of prospect fatigue just because he's always been on the door and has never actually had an opportunity in New York. I mean, if I were the Cincinnati Reds and I know that Brandon Nimmo was the name first, I'd rather have Dilson Herrera. And to me, I don't think it's that close.
No, I'm with you, and I feel the same way as a fantasy owner. Let me this just popped in my head, so it might be a terrible idea. But how do you see him as a fantasy asset compared to someone like Rougned Odor?
Interesting.
Like, if you think he can hit 20 homers in that park, I know Odor hit like his 22nd today, so he's maybe 20 plus.
Yeah,
but if you think Herrera is around 20, they're probably not that different, right? As fantasy assets?
No, I don't think they are. I wonder, I mean, how much has Odor been running this year? I should know that. I own him in like 3 leagues.
He runs, but he's not often successful.
Right. Well, so he's got 11 stolen bases this year.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Odor in terms of his offensive potential more than Herrera. I wonder, I mean, I guess this is just because of I guess, plate discipline issues with Odor. I mean, he's only walking like something like 2% this year.
Yeah,
I do wonder if there are issues, potential average issues, that you're looking at somebody who is going to hit 20 plus homers, and who knows how long the speed is actually going to be able to be around for Odor. And I wonder if, like, Dilson is going to be a better bet to hit 20 homers and have a higher average even if he doesn't run as much.
Right.
I don't know. And I mean, in terms of what Texas is going to bring to the table, I also think Odor is not necessarily going to hit at the top. You know, he's probably not going to be a number two hitter hitting in front of Joey Votto, for example, in terms of his run totals. I mean, Herrera, in terms of that, is attractive to me.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Matt, did you have any thoughts on that?
Maybe I'd probably lean more heavily towards Odor.
I think that's the natural inclination. I would too. I was just kind of thinking it through, is that if Herrera is a 20 homer guy, like what percentage do you think he is of Odor in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably something close. It's probably closer than I would have thought 10 minutes ago, now that I think about it a little more, but I'd still say Odor is a tier ahead.
Well, and I also wonder how much Herrera being a potential 20 homer guy is maybe in like 3 years.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, when he's 25 years old, rather than Odor right now has a chance to hit 25 plus.
Yeah. But at the same time, Odor was, I mean, I think just last year I was saying it's unlikely he's I think last year I said, I think he'll hit 20 homers in his career, and I think he'll hit, you know, I think he has the potential to hit like 290. I don't think he'll do it at the same time, and now I look like an idiot, which is nothing new, of course, but still. Last thing, because I've kept you guys for a while, and it's something I didn't touch on when we were talking about the Hill and Reddick trade, is what is your advice to fantasy owners about about what to do with Yasiel Puig?
I own him in a league, and I'm just kind of holding on to him and hoping for the best. I don't really know what else to do. I don't want to trade him because I'm terrified that I'm going to trade him for nothing, and then he's going to get back to his peak form. So I don't know that I would buy low on him if I didn't own him, but I think if you own him, you just have to hold on and hope for the best.
JP?
Yeah, I think that's the only thing you can do. I mean, I've always avoided Puig, and I've actually never owned him. I've always avoided him. And so that he would not be somebody that I would want to hold on to. But just in terms of opportunity cost, I don't see the upside of trading him other than maybe it feels good. I mean, it's the same kind of thing with Carlos Gomez that we were talking about earlier. If you get rid of him for nothing and he comes back and finds form, you're going to look like an idiot. I mean, and obviously not making moves because you're afraid to look stupid is tough, but you know, with somebody like Puig, how old is he? What?
25.
Okay, I would say 24, but 25 years old. I mean, there are so many more years for him available for him to find it again. But you know, we've been talking a lot about it, and I know that Craig, you and I have talked about it offline a bunch.
Yeah.
The players hitting and missing in the big leagues because of makeup and how often that matters, maybe, you know, just as much as skill set. It's just not, that's not somebody that I'm going to be putting a bet on just in terms of fantasy. Like, he's not somebody I'm not going to go to acquire him in any league.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something for me, that's one of those things where there's so much that we don't know or don't hear about. I mean, you also hear about, you know, makeup stuff, from behind the scenes too. And, you know, I think there are plenty of times it doesn't prevent the guy from working out, and there are times that it does. And it's so hard to just distinguish any signal from noise in that respect. And that's beyond, you know, knowing whether the person telling you about the makeup problem has like a certain way that they think people need to act and anyone else doesn't have the right makeup, or, you know, whatever it is. So it's something I generally just try not to even factor in. You know, at this point, I think with Puig, there's a dossier of information on, you know, kind of what he's like and how. And I don't think all of it's malicious or with negative intent, but, you know, there's clearly enough there where it seems like when he's focused and doing what the team has wanted him to do, he's experienced more success. And that when he's left to his own devices, again, without that intent being malicious, it does affect his on-field, you know, production.
Yeah. I mean, and it's also, I mean, not to just use this example for, because it's Matt's club, but like how much being on a team like Boston with like David Ortiz being there, like how much,
well, yeah, I don't, that, I mean, how'd that help Pablo Sandoval then?
Right. Well, sure. I mean, and you can also say it's not like Adrian Gonzalez isn't there, right? I mean, Adrian Gonzalez is by all accounts a good mentor and a good guy. And so, you know, I guess that doesn't necessarily pertain, but environment matters too, right? I mean, it's not makeup is not in a vacuum and it's not absolute. And how much giving a guy a chance to start over and be in a new team that doesn't have any preconceptions over how you are and what you are, or at least personally, I don't know if that matters or how much it does matter. I think if he does go to a new location and he does start to rake, I suspect that you'll see a bunch of articles about that. But it's a really difficult situation. And I know for fantasy owners, you know, looking at all the bat signal stuff that we get or questions that we get on Twitter, inaction is one of the most difficult things for fantasy owners to do. Mm-hmm. And it feeling like my decision is always buy or sell, and the idea that you can just hold and be patient doesn't ever feel like it is.
it's something that one can do. And I know that we were talking about it last year with Eric Hosmer and Moustakas, and just the idea that being patient and allowing guys to develop, fail, figure it out, make adjustments, etc., and just realizing that, you know, even this year with Jonathan Scope, like, he was called up at, what, 20 or 21 years old before he was ready, and yeah, he failed because he wasn't good enough yet, he wasn't developed enough yet, but had an opportunity to grow and figure out what his role is and what he is as a player. And now this year he's hitting like 280, you know, 15 plus homers, and is a top 10 fantasy second baseman. And like, it's not comparable because I know that we're talking about makeup, but the idea that you can sit and your solution to an issue is just holding tight, is very, very difficult for fantasy owners to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Sorry, that got soapboxy for a second.
No, it was good. I mean, Matt, did you have any agree?
No, I mean, I
want to rebuke me for mentioning Sandoval.
Yeah, I'm still reeling from that. You didn't bring up Alan Craig, so that was nice. But I agree with everything JP just said. That all sounded right to me.
Yeah, and one more person that I wanted to get your guys' take on, Enya. Sorry, that's a Tino thing, JP. You won't know.
I'm aware of this. I've seen it multiple times, and you've commented to me about it. I don't have strong feelings about Enya.